Study of the Bible and the Quran was at the heart of a three-day seminar this week at the English College Retreat House Palazzola in the hills overlooking Lake Albano, south of Rome. This peaceful and inspirational setting brought together some 22 Christian and Muslim scholars for the seventh in a series of seminars entitled Building Bridges. The meetings are organised by the Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, and the Catholic Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. This year, the scholars worked together on the rather grand theme, Communicating the Word, Revelation, Translation and Interpretation in Christianity and Islam. Though the organisers are anxious to keep the work of these meetings far away from the media spotlight, I managed to catch up with one of the regular participants to find out more about the goals and the history of this important initiative.
George Carey began it soon after the events of the 11th of September 2001. I think he held it early in 2002 at Lambeth Palace.
Jesuit Father Dan Madigan is well known here in Rome for his pioneering work in setting up the Institute for the Study of Religions and Cultures at the Pontifical Gregorian University. He's now moved to Georgetown University in the United States, but still serves here in the Vatican as a member of the Commission for Relations with Muslims.
It was a meeting in which there were some big names and, you know, princes and heads of state and so on.
People with a certain amount of influence.
But people also who were representing something. It was decided at that point that for the long term it was better to have something which was more reserved, more private, in which people were not there to represent some particular group or some particular country, but they were academics, basically, and their field is the study of Islam, the study of Christianity, and interreligious dialogue. And so that approach has been important, because you don't have people who feel they can't say something because they're representing, you know, this university or that constituency.
But an independence.
Yes,
to be
a certain
able
independence, because they're just
discuss
academics.
The issues on the
yes.
table.
The other thing which is very interesting about this series of seminars is the methodology. We study texts. So often in dialogue situations, we talk about big questions, and you read out the big question that was behind the whole thing. But the way we do it is by choosing texts from the Quran and from the Bible in order to study together in great detail and at length. That really focuses the discussion in a much more fruitful way than if you stay with all those abstract nouns of tradition.
It's interesting. This particular title is interesting, though, because of the fact that so many Christians think very firmly that Islam is a religion that cannot be interpreted, and therefore the very premise for the work that you've been doing is a mystery to some people.
It's always puzzled me that it's something that you hear repeated again and again, even in the highest quarters, that Muslims don't or will not or cannot interpret their scriptures, but you've only got to go into any Islamic library or any Islamic bookshop and you'll find a commentary on the Quran. One commentary on the Quran will take up, half a meter of book space shelf, 20 volumes, 30 volumes sometimes. It is certainly true that Muslims are suspicious of what they call interpretation, in the sense that they don't want to do what some people do with texts, which would be to say interpret them away. So you interpret it so much that it doesn't have any authority anymore, which is what they see that Christians have done with the Bible. It's you take it apart and you chop it up into little pieces and you say, well, this doesn't mean that and that doesn't mean this. And in the end, you've got nothing left. And many Christian biblical scholars have been rethinking their optimism about the so-called historical critical approach, that you don't find out how a motor car works, for example, by taking it all to pieces. You need to understand how it works together. So there's been this movement in Christian biblical interpretation, what they call canonical interpretation. So treat it as the sacred text of a community. Don't treat it simply as an ancient text that you need to understand where this verb came from or this piece of text came from, that book over there. That doesn't get you into the real role of Scripture, which is as the text of a community that believes. So it's just not true that Muslims don't interpret. There's a long tradition of legal interpretation, of trying to work out what is the context of this law in the Quran, what are the limits of it, who does it apply to, when does it apply, when does it not apply. There are very diverse opinions on some verses. Then there's a kind of mystical interpretation. You know, what does it mean when it says the likeness of God is light? You know, there's been mountains written on that question of God as light. People are coming to realize that any act of reading is already an act of interpretation. We think when we read things, we're just saying what's there. But what we think is there is actually at least partly in our mind and in our culture, and people have told us what's there. That is an act of interpretation. We focused a fair amount on that, but most of the Muslims who are there are academics, and so they don't have any problem with the idea of interpretation, and they're well-versed in philosophical approaches in the Western world.
They would represent the different branches of Islam, or would they mainly come from the Sunni tradition?
They're mainly Sunni. Most Muslims are mainly Sunni. There were among them Shiite Muslims also. Some Muslims who would identify themselves more as Sufi, others as modernist. A range of positions and approaches. A number of them have worked also, studied Christianity quite seriously too, and so they know very well our scriptures and our doctrines, and some of them have lived in Rome, and so these are people who are able to do comparative understanding of things.
There is a lot more study, I believe, within the Christian world at the moment of Islam than there is, though, of experts, Islamic experts, who also study Christianity. Is that true still?
It is still true, but there's a very quickly increasing number of people who are studying Christianity among Muslims. I think a lot of Christians still who study Islam study it in the context of what we might call security studies. I mean, I come from a university where there's quite a lot of the study of Islam and of the contemporary Arab world, but
At Georgetown,
yes. Most of the people who are doing it are focusing on the question of, you know, Middle East politics, world affairs, and so on. It's not as common, I think, among Christians really to study Islam and take it seriously as a religion, and to enter into some kind of theological approach to it. That's a little more rare.
It's an exciting time to be studying the Islamic-Christian relations, isn't it, after the common word, which seems to have set a new impetus in motion.
I think that's true, yes. I would have hoped that more people had responded to it. But, of course, any initiative like this takes time to be accepted and even to be known. I mean, it's known, I think, in the English-speaking world, partly because the responses have been quite a high profile, I think, to it. I see, you know, signs of hope at the moment in this kind of dialogue. I mean, there are many issues, but I think one thing we're getting over, I hope we still have some work to go do on this, is to reduce everything again to that kind of the political question. The political question is enormously important, but there are many people in this kind of work who have no political power, who have no say. So we can't say to every Muslim, the one who's selling the umbrella, or the one who's, you know, our doctor, or the one who's a fellow teacher, we can't say to every one of them, well, I'm not really going to talk to you about anything else until you discuss the political question about religious freedom and so on. It's not something they can really do anything about, and we can't put everything else on hold until that is solved. And the people who really have some possibility to do something about religious freedom and so on are people we're not prepared to speak harshly to, because they've got the oil we want, or they've got the you know, a certain political clout that we want to use in international tactic negotiation. So I don't know. I don't think it's fair to expect the rank and file Muslim to have to answer for these larger political questions, and for everything else to be put on hold in the meantime. Well, we don't say to the Saudi king, well, we're not going to sell you any arms until you let the Christians there have some freedom of worship. The US is still selling billions of dollars worth of arms and buying billions of dollars worth of oil every day. ¶¶
talking about it as a time of hope. The common word represented, in a certain way, a step forward.
Yes, it was a. It is an attempt by a group of Muslims who know Christianity and have studied it well, to try and say, okay, let's not take the traditional road that we've always argued about. Let's see if we can find some common starting point. It's a common starting point. It's not a common finishing point. So it's not trying to say, well, you know, we're basically the same. It's trying to say, well, we have this in common in our scriptures. If we could develop this, maybe we'd have a chance of understanding each other better. And from that point of view, I think it's an attempt in very good faith. And I don't entirely understand why some people are so suspicious of it.
I mean, what do you think provoked it?
What provoked it? Well, it came 1 year to the day after the letter that a group of 38 Muslims had written to the Holy Father about the question of faith and reason. And that was a very interesting letter, really responding to what he had said at Regensburg and explaining to him a bit about their position and whether, in fact, what he had said was an accurate presentation of Islam. It was a very well thought out and clearly argued and respectful letter, and one which was open to further discussion. Well, that didn't receive any direct answer from the Pope, and that I remember speaking to one of the signatories of that about the middle of last year, and he was still hopeful. He said that the delay, he said, meant that the people in the Vatican were working on the answer and they were taking it so seriously that it was taking a long time to. Well, I'm not sure he was right, but still, on 1 year to the day, they decided to show that they were still ready and to take even another step. And it's a new experience, I think, for the Church in some respects, because since the Second Vatican Council, really, it's the Catholic Church that's been pushing, because of the policy enunciated in Nostra Aetate and the fact that we have people full-time on this and a pontifical council devoted to it. The Catholic Church has been making the running in many respects. The World Council of Churches has certainly been doing work on this too, but in many respects a lot has followed on from Nostra Aetate. Now we're finding that we're not making the running. Here is a group of Muslims, quite a substantial group of Muslims, who are pushing the game along and showing that they are ready for dialogue and keen to have it and keen to have meetings. And they're serious scholars. They're people who've taken the trouble to understand who we are. Yeah, serious people. So we're playing catch up in some respects.
These latest developments have resulted in the establishment of a Catholic Muslim forum to be convened in November for the first time. What are your hopes for that? What would you like it to start looking at?
My hopes for it would be not too high, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but I think it's always important to keep in mind that the dialogue at its best doesn't necessarily happen on the big occasions in the high-level committees. Most dialogue takes place in very ordinary situations, and whether or not things are happening here in Rome or producing something, there is a lot happening all over the world, and so people have an unfortunate tendency sometimes to judge the stage we're at with Muslims as to how things are going in official circles, and I don't think that's a good measure. So it's going to be slow and patient work. You know, I wouldn't say, oh, well, you know, the November meeting is going to be the big breakthrough, and not because there's not goodwill, but simply because I think dialogue takes time and commitment and the preparedness to keep meeting and develop friendship and trust. One thing I would say, and I think it's very important for this meeting, which is a very significant meeting. I think there hasn't been anything quite like it before. There's a tendency sometimes on both sides to say, well, when we get together with them, we're going to say to them, you know, you've done such and such. We're going to give people a list of their sins. So if it's a meeting like that, it's not going to go anywhere. We both have sins, surely, and we can usually enumerate the sins of the other without being quite as aware of our own sins. And the most difficult kind of dialogue, but I think the most essential if we're going to break through, is what I call a dialogue of mutual repentance, where we can honestly say, well, these are our ideals. We have wonderful ideals, love of God, love of neighbor, peace, justice, any number of good things. When we get together and talk about our ideals, that's fine, but it's easy to get together and talk about our failings to live up to those ideals is much more difficult, takes much more courage. But in the end, that's the place we'll break through, because all the time that we're talking about ideals in the back of our minds, whichever community we belong to, in the back of our minds we're saying, yes, but they don't do it. So if we can meet on that level of honesty, and I think Pope John Paul was very important in this with his mea culpa during the Jubilee year. That's where we have to begin, although people are suspicious of that, and it's not easy. Whoever said confession was easy? But it's good for the soul.
And my thanks there to Father Dan Madigan, visiting international fellow at the Woodstock Theological Center at Georgetown University and a member of the Vatican's Commission for Relations with Muslims.